Welcome to the teaching ministry of Walt East, lead chaplain at Sky Valley Chapel. We hope this teaching will serve as a practical guide for your daily walk as a Christ follower. We encourage you to follow along with your Bible and life notes, which can be found in the podcast show notes or on our website at svmin.com.
Well, today we're going to study one of my favorite passages in the Gospel of Mark, and in fact, it's one of my favorite passages in the entire Bible. And one of the reasons I love this story so much is because it's a story of faith. It's a story of a faith that a dad has in Jesus. It's also a story where you have a father who deeply loved his son. And I realize this is Mother's Day, but this is a story of a good father that spent his life caring, helping, and protecting his son that was helpless, scared, and disfigured. It's a story of a father that saved his son's life more than once. He loved his son so much that no matter how hopeless things seemed to be, this father never gave up on the boy. He never stopped loving his son. He never stopped caring for his son. This is a good dad. And I love that about this story. You see, too often we hear about absent fathers. We hear about abusive fathers. And some of us in our own lives have experienced that. So here is a good father willing to make his entire life about caring for and protecting his child. Before we meet this great father and his helpless son, I want to take a moment to give you an overview of how this story fits into the Gospel of Mark and what Jesus is trying to teach his disciples. And when he's trying to teach his disciples, by extension, he's trying to teach today's disciples, which is you and me, people who are Christ followers, people who are apprentices to Jesus. Jesus, at this point in the Gospel of Mark, is trying to teach them. He's less than 6 months away from the cross. And for almost 2.5 years, he has poured his life into Peter and the guys. They've been together. The apostles had watched Jesus perform miracles. They'd heard him teach. They knew Jesus well. They'd lived with him. They followed him by sight. But in the next 6 months, Jesus is going to face the cross, and he's going to die. And they would need to learn to follow Jesus by faith, not by sight. They would need to learn how to access the power of Jesus when he was absent, not just when he was present there with him in the flesh. So how were they supposed to do that? How could Jesus' disciples then, and you and me as disciples now, access the power of God when Jesus is not physically with us, when we are living by faith in Jesus and not by sight? Well, this story, I believe, gives us an answer. It teaches how the original disciples learned how to access the power of Christ, and it's a lesson on living in faith for us today in the 21st century. If you haven't got them out yet, pull out that half sheet of paper that says Life Notes at the top and invite you to take a few notes as you go along. Now, incidentally, this story that we're studying this morning is also told in Matthew 17 and in Luke 9, and we're going to reference parallel accounts to this story from those two Gospels, although this story in Mark is a bit longer. As you may recall, who was Mark's primary source? Peter. And Peter was an eyewitness to all this, and Peter told Mark extensively about what was going on here. This is why this in Mark's Gospel is probably about twice as long as the way the story is told in Matthew and Luke, but we can learn some things from those other two Gospels that we're going to pull in as we go. Now, we saw in the verses a couple weeks ago, just prior to this, that Jesus took Peter, James, and John to the top of a high mountain where Jesus was transfigured before them. For a brief period of time, God the Father let Jesus transcend his human form. Fully God, complete divinity and humanity joined in one. And Jesus' face, we're told, it shone with a glory and a brightness more brilliant than the sun. His clothes became white as light. One of the writers said, whiter than anything on earth could bleach them. And the three apostles were there with him. Peter, James, and John. We know that Moses and Elijah came up. And these guys, as they were leaving that incident up there, they're descending down the mountain, they find a scene of complete chaos. And just as Moses, when he came down from Mount Sinai to the Israelites, he found them failing in their faith. He found them in complete chaos in the valley below. When Jesus and Peter, James, and John come down, they also find the remaining nine apostles failing in their faith and in complete chaos in the valley below. Now, as we work through this text to give some form to the story, we're going to group our study under three different problems: the problem of demons, the problems of unbelief, and the problem of prayerlessness. First off, the problem of demons. It says in verse 14, when they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. So Jesus and the three were gone for approximately 5 days here. And when they arrived at the bottom of the mountain, they found the remaining nine apostles had drawn a crowd. There were scribes gathering there with them. The teachers of the law, the scripture tells us, there's scribes gathering around them and arguing with them. Now, why is the crowd there? Well, it's probably because everybody loves to see a good fight, right? Remember back in junior high school, if you heard there was going to be a fight after school, where'd you head for? Over by the bike racks or wherever it was that the fights took place. I don't know about you, but that was my experience in high school. So when that kind of stuff happens, it kind of draws people together. You have something happen on the street and there's a fight on the street. You know, people, you know, most people stop to see what's going on. Well, how did these scribes get here? We know that Jesus had intentionally left. We've talked about this over and over again over the last few weeks. Jesus had intentionally left Galilee. He'd gone about 25 miles north to the area of Caesarea Philippi because he wanted to avoid constant conflicts with the religious leaders. He traveled up there. He wanted to spend some time teaching his apostles. And apparently these scribes, this group of scribes, had tracked Jesus down. They were kind of like the bounty hunter scribes, you know, like Dog the Bounty Hunter, trying to find him. But they didn't find Jesus when they got there. They found the remaining nine because Jesus and Peter, James, and John, as I said, were up on the mountain. And so with Jesus, Peter, James, and John gone, well, this kind of tipped the odds in the favor of the scribes. And it wasn't going well for those nine apostles down at the bottom. They were losing to the scribes with the crowd watching. And right now with these nine apostles losing so badly, it would have been a great time to be able to tag someone else into the fight. And that's exactly what happened. Jesus showed up, and he tags in the fight, and he takes the heat off of the other nine. Let's see what happens here in verse 15. It says, as soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. So, you know, they're there to watch the fight, and then someone says, well, there's Jesus. So, they go over, look at Jesus, go be with Jesus. So he returns from the mountain, they see him, they immediately go over to where he's at. And I can picture these nine disciples, you know, they're totally relieved at this point. Go get him, Jesus. Whew. Glad we're out of it now. Glad we don't have to continue that. It says the crowd was overwhelmed when they saw Jesus. They were amazed. They were awestruck. They wanted to see Jesus. And everybody ran to him hoping to be in the front row for whatever he had to give him. But Jesus asks a question when he gets down there. He says, what are you arguing with them about? Now, who's he asking this question of? His disciples. You know, you got all these people, you got the crowd, you got these scribes in all here. Who does Jesus address? He addresses the ones that should have been more mature, the ones that should have been more in line with what should be going on. I don't know about you, but I was the oldest child. I was the oldest of three boys, and you know how boys are, you know, you get in fights and you do stuff and all that. And guess who always got asked the question? Who did my mom always ask? It was me, because I was the oldest. Walt, what's going on here? What are you arguing with your brothers about? Well, why don't you ask them, you know? But the ones that you think should have more maturity, the ones that you should be more responsible, that's who you address. So Jesus is talking to his disciples here. He says, what are you arguing with them about? Now, it's interesting here. First off, the scribes didn't answer the question. Of course, they weren't being asked. And the other nine didn't answer the question either. You know, maybe because they were too embarrassed, they were too ashamed, they didn't want to admit, you know, they were fighting a fight and losing it. But thankfully, someone comes forward and explains what the argument's all about down there. And then we get some details here in verse 17. A man in the crowd answered, teacher, I brought you my son, who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth. He gnashes his teeth and he becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. Now, if you're one of those disciples down there at that time, you feel any better now? Probably not. We have a man with a demon-possessed son. He brought his son to the apostles. He wanted them to cast out the demon because Jesus was gone, but they failed. And you can imagine, I can imagine a scene there, each apostle trying to do it, all the guys one by one trying to maybe even a couple of them ganging up on the demon, trying to cast it out, but they're all failing. They're all failing. Nothing's happening. And they look powerless here. They look like fools in public in front of the crowd, in front of the Father, in front of the scribes. And so since they couldn't cast the demon out of the boy, you can imagine this verbal beating that the scribes were giving them. I'm sure the scribes were calling them fakes and phonies and failures. Never mind that the scribes couldn't cast out any demons of their own. They were thrilled to take this opportunity to publicly shame the 9 disciples of Jesus who turned their attempts at exorcism into a complete failure. Now, while the scribes were busy shaming the disciples, what should have pulled their heartstrings was the gripping story that the Bible gives us about the boy and his father. Mark tells us that the father had brought his mute son to be healed. His son had a need. It was beyond the father's ability to take care of his son. He'd spend his life trying to protect his son, trying to take him. But he heard about this teacher. He'd heard about this man who could cast out demons. And he thought, let me take my son and see if this could happen. And okay, the man's not here. Well, you're his disciples. You're his followers. You have the same power he does. The boy could not speak, not because there was something wrong with him physically, but it was because there was something wrong with him spiritually. A demon oppressed him that made him mute. Later in the story, we're going to see that this demon didn't just make him mute, but it also made him deaf. He couldn't hear. He could see his father. He could see others around him, but he couldn't hear them, and he couldn't speak to them. So the demon imprisoned him in his body and forced him to kind of just watch life going on. He could not communicate with others. He couldn't hear from others. He could gesture, and that's about it. He was completely alone in his own world. Later, we're going to see that this demon also gave this boy terrifying seizures. Now, we don't usually think of muteness and deafness and seizures as something associated with demonic possession. We think of demonic possession like the Gadarene demoniac, the man of the tombs that we saw back in Mark chapter 5, the guy who was running around crazy, the guy that sat up on the cliffs and cut himself with the stones, the guy that went around screaming and cutting himself. Sometimes that is what demonic possession looks like. However, if we look around the Bible, we find that demonic possession, demonic oppression, occasionally manifests itself in debilitating physical conditions. Let me show you what I mean. We've already seen that while there was nothing wrong with this boy physically, the demon had made him deaf and mute. In Matthew 12:22, we see that a demon made a man mute and blind. There's nothing wrong with the man physically, it's just the demon kept him from speaking or hearing. In Luke 13:11, we see a demon that has left a woman crippled. That woman was not crippled physically. She was crippled by the work of the demon in her life. So we see that demonic oppression can occasionally manifest itself, not in making someone howling crazy, but by physical conditions that produce suffering. Now, some people have asserted that this boy in the story simply suffered from a case of epilepsy. The problem with that is the Bible clearly distinguishes between physical sickness and demonically originated sickness. If this boy did have a severe case of epilepsy, the epilepsy didn't come from the physical problem. Its origin was the presence of a demon. That was his problem. That was his issue. So we need to remember that sometimes physical sickness and suffering is caused by a physical problem. Other times physical sickness and suffering can be caused by demonic oppression. But not everything is by demonic oppression. Everything is by the fall. Everything is because of sin back from the third chapter of Genesis. But there's a lot of people, they want to see a demon under every bush, and they think they give Satan more credit and the demons more credit than what they deserve, okay? Because they want to say everything is coming from the demons. No, it's not. Some of it's just physical sickness that we have as a result of living in a fallen world. The root cause of a physical problem can be a demonic problem, but it's not always a demonic problem. Now, know what else this demon did to the boy. When the demon took control of him in a seizure, it threw him to the ground where he foamed at the mouth, he gnashed his teeth, and he became rigid. Now, would you agree it'd be terrible to watch your child go through this? Can you imagine him throwing himself to the ground, foaming at the mouth, rolling around on the floor? Luke tells us that this demon scarcely left him. these demonic seizures didn't happen just once every 6 months or even once a week. They were happening constantly to this boy. Luke also tells us that the boy was the man's only child. The father had dedicated his entire life to caring for this demon-possessed boy. And later we would see that this demon's purpose was not just to torment the boy. The demon's purpose was to kill him. The demon would put him in a seizure so that he lost control of his body. And the demon would force the boy to throw himself into harm's way, either into the fire or into water. And can you imagine the terror this boy experienced during these seizures? To not be able to control your own body, and there's a fire there, and you're moving towards the fire, but you don't want to move towards the fire, but you're moving towards it. He couldn't scream. He couldn't let out a yell or anything because the demon had made him mute, therefore effectively gagging him. And imagine the terror of this boy. The demon would throw him into bodies of water in the convulsing state in order to kill him. And each time the demon threw the boy into a body of water to drown him, there was always a second splash. It was the boy's father jumping in to save him. So we have a very, very desperate father here who's traveled miles with his son to have a demon cast out. The father begged the disciples to cast out the demon, but they failed. They could not. They failed miserably. And what makes this strange is that Jesus had given them the power to cast out demons a few chapters ago, three chapters ago, in fact, in chapter 6. There it says, they drove out many demons. He's talking about Jesus' disciples. They drove out many demons and anointed many people, many sick people with oil and healed them. Well, it worked for them before this time. What went wrong with this one? And that brings us to our next problem in our outline, the problem of unbelief. Jesus tells them, verse 19, he says, "Oh, unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you?" I don't know about you, but I heard my mom say that more than once. "How long should I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." Now, this is not a normal greeting. "Oh, unbelieving generation." This is an expression of exasperation on the part of Jesus. Jesus called his disciples an unbelieving or a faithless generation. Their trust, their faith that Jesus would take care of the situation had waned. Jesus said, "How long do I need to put up with you? How long do I have to be with you? How long do I have to be here until you learn how to handle these situations?" And he's probably thinking in his mind, "I don't have much time left with you guys. You need to go launch out into the world." Luke, in his parallel account, tells us that Jesus said that they were crooked, they were deviant, they were perverse. He's saying, how'd you guys get so messed up so fast? I wasn't even gone a week and already you're falling apart. But then Jesus takes control of the situation. He says, "Bring a boy to me." And says in verse 20, "So they brought him. When the Spirit saw Jesus, it immediately," that's one of those key words I told you in Mark, immediately or at once. When you see that in your Bible, in the Gospel of Mark, circle immediately or at once. Mark uses that often. Mark's is a fast-moving gospel. "It immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth." So as the boy was brought to Jesus, the demon went into action. One thing to note in this story is that this demon reacted differently than the other demons that we've seen previously in Mark's gospel. In Mark chapter 1, where there was a demon-possessed man in the synagogue, when that demon saw Jesus, it screamed in fear. In Mark chapter 5, when we get to the Gadarene demoniac, the man of the tombs, that demon, even though he had many demons in him, he ran up to Jesus and he fell on his knees trembling. This demon in chapter 9 was different. It was obstinate. It was stubborn. And rather than cowering in fear in front of Jesus, this hard-nosed demon went back to attacking and destroying the boy right in front of Jesus. While all demons are under the authority of Jesus, this particular demon showed little respect for the authority of Jesus. Could that be why the disciples couldn't cast it out in the first place? We're going to see. Verse 21, Jesus addresses the father. It says, Jesus asked the boy's father, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered. It has often thrown him into the fire or water to kill him. Now, why did Jesus ask the father this question? Let me tell you something that you need to always, always, always remember. When God asks you a question, anytime God asks you a question, all the way back to the garden, all the way back to when God the Father came into the garden and asked Adam and Eve, who told you you were naked? God isn't asking for information. God already knows. He already knows all things. He doesn't ask questions for information. And it's hard for us to understand that because we live in a Western context. And in the Jewish context, rabbis used to teach by asking questions. The rabbis used this as a way to draw things out to help people figure out the answers for themselves. It's an inductive method rather than a deductive method. So he said, how long has it been like this? If it had been 5 years or 5 months, would it have made a difference to Jesus? No, it wouldn't have. So why did he ask this question? I think he asked them so that everybody here would get to hear the story, especially his disciples. I think the reason he asked this question is because Jesus is not a power who just heals. Jesus is a person who genuinely cares. Jesus cared about this father. He cared about the boy. He wanted to hear the father's pain. He was not just going to heal the boy, but he wanted to hear the father's story. He wanted to let the father tell his story so that he could help assuage his pain. And perhaps he was modeling a caring, pastoral concern for the benefit of his disciples. Did you guys even ask the father what the background of this was, what was going on? Rather than, oh boy, here's a demon, we get to cast it out and look like we're powerful. If there's one thing that comes out clearly in all of Jesus' miracles is that Jesus doesn't just want to heal people, he cares about people. He cares so much that he wants to hear their stories. And this is not just true about the Father, but this is true of you and me. And I don't know what pain you may be facing today. Maybe concerns about your children keep you up at night, or your grandchildren keep you up at night. Maybe it's difficulty with health or difficulty with finances. Who listens? Who genuinely cares and is not bored when you cry on their shoulder? Jesus does. He cares about your pain and he wants to hear your story. The Father continues speaking here. He says, but if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. Jesus next asks a rhetorical question, which isn't really a question, it's a statement. If you can, said Jesus, everything is possible to him who believes. Now again, this isn't a question. This is an exclamation. If you can, like, you got to be kidding me. Do you think the demon that possesses your son is a problem for me to cast out? How could you be asking that question? All things are possible to him that believes. You see, God can do anything for one who simply comes to Jesus asking for his help. Jesus said, the reason your son was not healed is not because I don't have the ability to heal. There's something else that's keeping your son from being healed. It's because there was a lack of faith in me to heal. The issue was not that God doesn't have the power to heal this boy. The issue was the disciples weren't turning in faith to Jesus. They weren't asking God to cast out this demon. They were trying to do it in their own power. And we're going to see that at the end here when Jesus tells them. And this is an especially important lesson for the disciples. The reason they couldn't cast out the demon was not because they didn't have the power available to them. The issue was they kept relying, as I said, on their own giftedness, on their own strength, rather than in faith, calling on Jesus, praying for his strength to cast the demon out. Remember what Jesus was doing. He was preparing his disciples for how to live when he was not around. He was teaching them what to do when they found themselves facing something that was greater than their own abilities, something that was greater than they could handle on their own. What should they do? Instead of relying on themselves, in faith they needed to turn to him. They needed to pray and ask for his help. They needed to ask for God's help in handling the issues that were beyond their ability. So this father got it. He got it. He understood that somebody needed to place their faith and trust in Jesus' ability to cast out the demon rather than in their own ability. The father had not been able to get rid of the demon in his own strength. The disciples had not been able to get rid of the demon in their own strength. But Jesus has the power and strength. And so the father immediately places his faith in Jesus. It says, immediately. Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. And when I told you at the beginning, this is one of my favorite stories in all of Scripture, it's because of this verse right here. Mark 9:24. Lord, I believe. Help me to overcome my unbelief. The Father humbly says, I have some faith. I know it may not be perfect, but I do believe in you. This is a common prayer of mine. Lord, I've got faith. I know who you are. Help me to overcome the unbelief. Help me to trust you more and more. The word exclaimed here is a translation of a very strong word in the Greek. The word is the exact opposite of half-heartedness. It is a cry of desperation. It's the moment one thing becomes worth everything. And this is the one thing that mattered in the father's life, was to see his boy delivered from this demon. This was the father crying out to Jesus in prayer, in faith, asking Jesus to save his son. And I love what he says there, as I said, help my unbelief. My faith and trust in you, it may be wavering, it may not be perfect, but help me. I pray that I have enough faith to access your limitless power to cast the demon out of my boy. And what I love best, Jesus is okay with that. He did not expect the man to have perfect faith. He didn't expect the man to be able to write some theological treatise like Thomas Aquinas or something like that. He honored the faith that the man had and the heart that the man had. All of us have our faith mixed with doubt and fears, if we're honest. But for Jesus, that imperfect faith is sufficient for the power of God to heal the man's son. It says in verse 25, when Jesus saw that crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the evil spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, he's dead. Now, let me just interject another point here. It's not in your notes, but sometimes, folks, things are going to appear to get worse before they get better. That's just a fact of life. You can call on God, but sometimes it may seem like things are going to get worse before they get better, the same way it happened here. Keep that in mind when that happens in your life, because it will. It says, at this point, the crowd was starting to gather. Everyone wanted to see what would happen. And since Jesus has passed the first half of the gospel, like I said a few weeks ago, you have a turning point in Mark chapter 8 where Jesus now focuses on his disciples. Jesus is not performing miracles now for the crowd to see. He's performing miracles in order to teach his boys, teach Peter and James and John and all these other guys. He's trying to teach them. So before the crowd got too big, Jesus commanded the demon to come out of the boy and to never harass him again. And we already saw that this demon was a stubborn one, didn't we? Unlike these other demons that cowered in fear, this demon, he liked to act out in front of Jesus. And the same thing took place again here. When Jesus commanded it to come out, the demon went into overdrive. He threw the boy on the ground again, and then these violent convulsions. And in Greek, the word that's translated violently is a very descriptive language. It means convulsions that were worse than this boy had ever experienced before. It's kind of like the demon's last stand there. And right in front of Jesus, it happened, and the boy's laying there looking like he's dead. It says in verse 27, But Jesus took the boy by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. In the quiet moments after this tumult was over, Jesus reached down, he grabbed the boy's hand, and he helped him to his feet. He gave him health. He gave him life. He gave him healing. He gave him strength so the boy could stand. In the Gospel of Luke, Luke tells us Jesus rebuked the evil spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. I want you to picture this moment. The loving, concerned father receiving his son restored back to him in full health by Jesus. Can you see the tears running down the father's face? Can you see his chest heaving with joy? The muteness and the deafness of his son was gone. They could speak to one another. His boy was not rigid or foaming at the mouth. He was squeezing his dad as tight as he could. And I don't know what the little boy said, but I can imagine him saying, I love you, Dad. I love you, Papa. I thank you for taking care of me. I thank you for pulling me out of the fire. Thank you for pulling me out of the water. I thank you for never, ever, ever, ever giving up on me. I thank you for never letting me go. And did you think the gratitude and love from a son to a father in this moment is overwhelming? Well, just imagine even more gratitude from both a son and a father to Jesus for saving this boy's life. But the question still lingers. It's a big one. Why couldn't the disciples cast out the demon? Now, we've given you some hints here and all, but that brings us to our third point. It's the problem of prayerlessness. The problem of prayerlessness. It says in verse 28, after Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we drive it out? He replied, this kind can come out only by prayer. By prayer. Now, we don't know what house they went into. In the Gospel of Mark, whenever the disciples enter a house, it was always a time for Jesus to give private instruction to them. It's a time for Jesus to explain things to them that they didn't understand out there amongst the crowds. And Jesus said there was a simple reason why they could not drive out this demon. It was because they hadn't bothered to pray. Imagine that. They hadn't bothered to pray. Disciples that had spent years with Jesus didn't know that when Jesus was gone and there was a problem that was more than they could handle, all they needed to do was to stop and to pray. And what is prayer? Prayer is just talking to God. It's communion with God. It's admitting that you can't do things on your own and asking God to help you with things. If they had prayed, the presence and the power of Jesus would have been with them. The presence and power of Jesus through prayer would have been enough to cast out this demon, but they were trying to do it in their own power. I don't know how people live life without the power of God in their life. I don't understand how they can do that. But there's a danger for each and every one of us to try and do that, whether working a job in a factory some, or even if we're a pastor preaching from a pulpit. I can't do what I do up here without prayer. God forbid I would ever try to teach without praying to God and asking God to lead me, to guide me, and guide me as I'm preaching to folks. But the same is true for every other decision in my life, and it's true for every decision in your life. You need to talk to the Father in prayer and ask him what to do when you come to the end of your rope. Now this brings us to the point of the story, the conclusion. When we find ourselves in situations that are more than we can handle, we should turn to Jesus in prayer instead of relying on our own strength. The disciples had been able to cast out demons. They used this ability quite well in chapter 6. But when they ran across this particularly stubborn demon, rather than turning to Jesus in prayer and asking for his help, they tried to do it on their own. In essence, the disciples were prideful. They were prideful. Did you ever have the experience where your child's trying to do something and it's beyond their ability to do, and you try to help them, you want to help them? Nope, I got it on my own. I got it on my own. Well, what do you do? I learned you don't force yourself on them. You just sit back, you wait, you love them. You allow them to come to that conclusion, Dad, can you help? Sure. And then you step in. All I'm doing there is I'm modeling our Heavenly Father. I'm modeling our Heavenly Father because he's there. He wants to help us. He wants us to depend upon him. He wants us to admit that we can't do it and ask for his help. They thought they could do this on their own. They were too proud to pray. They forgot that it wasn't their ability that mattered. It was God's power that mattered. And if they had been humble and desperate like this father who was willing to offer a simple, desperate prayer to Jesus, that would have been enough to handle the stubborn demon. Jesus didn't say, oh yeah, guys, you shouldn't have even tried this. There's no way you guys could have done this. What did he tell them? You need to pray. You need to tap into the source. You need to humble yourself, put your pride aside, and ask me for help. This lesson, as I said, applies to all of us because it's easy for us to rely upon our natural gifts to solve our problems and never ask for God's help. There's a lot of men and women that are going to die and go to hell because they're too prideful to admit that they need God in their lives. They try to live this life on their own, and they butt their heads, and they butt their heads, and they butt their heads, and they get bruises because they won't admit, I need help. Oftentimes, when we have a problem that's more than we can handle, our default is to try harder in our own strength. And this story teaches us that when we find ourselves facing things beyond us, just like the disciples did, we're to go to Jesus in prayer. Secondly, God often places us in situations. God will allow situations to come into our life where these situations are beyond our ability, And they will teach us to pray so that we can depend upon Him. He will give us opportunities to turn to Him and depend upon Him. Did you ever consider that maybe Jesus was gone for a reason when this went down, when this man brought his son? Maybe this was orchestrated by Jesus. This time, God's timing is always perfect. Did you think that maybe Jesus planned for his 9 disciples to be alone when they met this little boy who was possessed by a stubborn demon that wouldn't respect their authority? I think Jesus put the disciples in this situation so they would learn why they needed to pray to Jesus to help them in these kind of situations. Because again, 6 months from now, he's not going to be with them anymore. And they're going to have to turn to him in prayer as they go through the persecution that's surely going to come. Because he said, you're going to be persecuted. Look at what they're going to do to me. They're going to do the same to you. And you've heard me say it before. The way Jesus dealt with people then is what? Is the way that Jesus deals with people now. Say that with me. The way that Jesus dealt with people then is the way that Jesus deals with people now. It hasn't changed, folks. Nothing's different. Jesus is still in the business of teaching us to pray and teaching us to rely upon Him instead of ourselves. And to do that, God occasionally and intentionally puts us in situations that are beyond our ability to handle so that we will learn to turn to Him in prayer. And all of us will face these kind of situations. All of us will. If you haven't yet, or you don't think you have yet, you're either oblivious to it, or you haven't lived life long enough, but I know that's not the case here. The question is, when we face those times, what will we do? Will we be like the disciples and try to do it, try to handle things in our own, under our own strength, because we're too proud to admit that we need God's help? Or will we be like this humble and desperate father and cry out to Jesus for the help that only He can provide? What a story.
Thank you for joining us for this message. For more information on Chapel Mall and the ministry of Sky Valley Chapel, please visit our website at svmin.com. You can support this ministry on our website, Facebook page, or by downloading our app in the Apple or Google Play Store. Have a blessed day.